It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 5.0.
Word of advice, never try to make a griffin your pet.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
We have with us today Aaron Hoffman, author of, where did the book go? Sword of Fire and Sea. I'm sorry, I got in a weird conversation earlier this week in which people thought this book was the George R. R. Martin book. So that confused me. So,
is there a similar George R. R. Martin title?
Well, the series is called A Song of Ice
Song
and
of Fire,
Fire and Ice or whatever.
Right, yeah. Gotcha.
But anywho, welcome to the show, Aaron.
Thanks.
So let's start with the big first introductory question, which is, what drew you into writing and why fantasy in particular?
You know, I kind of fell into it. I was wandering through racks at the library one summer when I was a kid and stumbled across a Piers Anthony book, and that was basically the beginning of the end. I read too much. Usually your parents are kind of happy when you read, but I managed to push them to the point where they became unhappy with how much I was reading. So, and almost all fantasy.
That's a good problem to have, I think.
Well, I hope so. I think it turned out all right in the end.
Yeah. To start off with, you mentioned in your acknowledgement that the world of Andvare was created as a collaborative effort online. Could you tell us a little bit more about sort of your world-building process? I mean, how did this all work?
Sure. It's a story that becomes slightly embarrassing, or maybe not. Maybe this is the new world of the way that people are finding writing. I was online on AOL, and I was actually swapping disks. It was back when you could only get like 5 or 10 hours at a time, so you could just cycle and keep changing your screen name with all these trial disks. And I found this group of people online. I think it was actually a Griffin's message board, strangely enough. I don't know why there was a Griffin's message board, but there was. In talking to the people there, we decided that we were collectively 15-year-old disgusted with the available fan writing groups around, and we're going to create our own. And so I just drew up this map and started writing a bunch of backstory for this world so that we could write with griffins, and that was pretty much it.
So did you're the one that designed the world, but did they help create the backstory with you, or was it primarily of your own making?
It was quite collaborative in the time that we were kind of getting off the ground. We had basically people would come with their own backgrounds, and we had this sort of contrivance, which actually does feature into the book later, of this interplanar gate that these other characters could come through and enter into this world. So I created the backstory for the world that they were in, and then we had, there's a core of 3 or 4 of us that were kind of adding to it, so there are parts in there that are shared, but I went and reinvented a lot of that later.
All right, so you did, sorry, we're going to have to start my thought process over.
Yeah, I'm sorry
about
that.
You better be deleting this, Duke.
No, I'm going to leave it in, because anything that messes up Jen is gravy.
You just love that, right? okay, so you... So what made you inevitably decide to turn that world that you had worked with on with those people into this book?
Well, so I knew from a pretty young age that I wanted to be a writer. I actually had written to Piers Anthony when I was a kid about being a writer, and he wrote back to me telling me how hard it was. but I kept sticking with it, and I went to the Odyssey Fantasy Writers Workshop in 2005. I started connecting with other writers and really learning the whole process. I got rejection letters from Marion Zimmer Bradley, and I thought that all of this writing that we had done, and it was, I think I counted it up at one point, and just my contributions to this online thing were well over 300,000 words. It was a ton of writing, and I thought, oh, it's kids stuff, I can't use any of that. And I went through this period where I kind of put it all away for about 5 or 6 years at a time. And then as I was getting back into it and thinking about what kind of novel I would want to write, I started digging through this stuff, and it was very nostalgic. And I remembered what a great time we had and realized that there were a lot of things about the world that were kind of really deep taproot concepts in fantasy for me. And I thought, oh, why don't I just experiment with taking this world 1600 years in the future from where we were writing it and make it kind of like an Age of Sail in the same world. And that was it.
That's actually really interesting. I mean, the concept of taking what you had and moving it forward, because then, you know, you have the basis, you have the history, and you can create something new out of it.
Right, because I knew that if I was going to be writing a novel with it, that I basically had to reinvent it, if for no other reason than to make sure that it was mine and not, you know, part of things that other people had contributed to it. So I had to kind of edit down the world and then reinvent it in ways that would make it more wholly mine, but still have these parts that we all remembered from it.
I actually had a question about, because, you know, talking about this world building, and obviously the magic system in the world that you've created is it's based on the elements, fire, wind, water, or fire, air, water, earth. And earth is not as prevalent, at least in this book, but certainly water and fire are. And I'm curious if, were you concerned at all, and it seems like you started this project fairly a long time ago, but were you concerned that people might make sort of unfair connections between your work and, like, the Avatar cartoon series? Because that cartoon series also has an element-based magic system, and I'm sure that's not anything new. But I'm just kind of curious that there are differences between the systems, but I don't know, I'm just curious if you were at all concerned about that.
Yeah, it's really funny, actually. I was only peripherally aware of Avatar, and especially because I'm writing this back in, like, I wrote the first third of the book in 2003, and I don't know when Avatar, The Last Airbender, came out, but I think it was after that. So I was so deeply in what I was doing that I was not aware of them, which was bad. And then when I had sold the book, Lou described it as Michael Moorcock's Eternal Champion meets Avatar The Last Airbender, and I wasn't familiar with either of those two properties. So I had to go through and start reading them and watching them. Of course, I loved both of them. I was like, whoa, of course, this is, you know, I should have been more aware of this. But at that point, I had already sold the book. So what was I going to do?
Well, and they bought it. And if they had those concerns, they would have been the ones to talk about it. So one of the interesting things about your magic system is that, you know, these elements are in conflict in some ways. Obviously, they all work together as well. But your main character has fire and water working within him, and obviously they give him a bit of grief and because they're fighting against each other. What compelled you to develop a magic system which, you know, in a way lacks unity but makes their life difficult? And how did you decide to focus on the fire and sea duality as opposed to some of the other elements?
So I actually am not sure where the whole elemental thing first emerged, because it was part of the world from the very, very beginning. So I know that we had way, way back, we had these griffins called Prime Adepts that could use all of the elements at the same time. And they're kind of these almost now mythical griffins that can no longer exist because the strength of the magic is not what it once was. And so I knew that thread had to kind of persist, and I wanted to play with a time in which the magic has all but gone away from the world. It has almost become legendary itself. And then I also wanted to have a ship captain be the main character, so it seemed natural that he should have come from sea people and water people. And I wanted this concept that the elements had actually infused the culture, so they almost replace race in a way from our world. And the natural conflict for him would be if he had this sort of Romeo and Juliet story from his ancestors between the water and fire families.
I hadn't thought of it as kind of a racial element, but now that you've mentioned it, you know, you definitely have distinct types of people, you know, each wielding their own elements, obviously.
And
but you
the
also
griffins
decided
like that too.
Right, and the griffins. You also decided to go with a matriarchal society.
but it's one that's kind of in conflict, that the main character is in conflict with. What inspired going in that direction?
Yeah, so I think I'm playing a lot of gender things in the book too, or at least I'm trying to, or it was in my mind that I wanted to kind of flip some assumptions upside down. So one of the things is that Darian, the main character, has a first mate who is a woman. And I wanted to deliberately create a world where some of our assumptions were upside down. So the Darian, the main character, has a first mate who is a woman, and she's very superstitious about the presence of elements on there, what's bad luck, as opposed to just having a woman on the ship. So I wanted a world where there are lots of female ship captains, or maybe not lots, but there's at least a fair representation of them. And also in with the magic, partly it was because it's a little bit of an homage to the people that were in the writing group way back when. We were, it was almost entirely girls, women. And so I wanted the magic users to be female, and this sort of dynamic where the magic had been channeled through women because of this thing that had happened historically, and the way that it is channeled in men is very different. So you do eventually meet Ariadel's father, who's a magic user, but he's kind of not exactly illicit, but the ways that they have to use magic are very, very different, which of course is going to change through some of the stuff that happens in the book.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you've kind of, though, set up a world where that's not necessarily a good thing, that women have all the power. I mean, they're kind of the bad guys by the end of it. Well, they become the good guys again, but still, you've set up a not a competition, you know, a conflict between the women and the men. Did you intentionally want to set up that kind of that strife, or was it just something that you wanted to be able to resolve?
So I think that there's this underlying of imbalance, the way that the world is when we start out, and that was a dimension of the imbalance and a way in which the world has become different than it was before, and things that have to be realigned through massive change that the existing powers in the world are going to resist. So it was just one way that that sort of manifested.
Cool.
So just switching gears real quick, because we haven't read a lot of like high fantasy sort of adventurous novels on this show.
We haven't,
which is very odd, because you would think we'd get more, but we don't. We have gotten a lot of sort of more urban fantasy. And so yours very much fits in sort of that high fantasy category. It's got lots of fantastic creatures. There's lots of cool magic, flames, and ships exploding. It's awesome. And then, of course, you do have the idea of, like, the cliche quest. But you make a shift on that quest because your quote-unquote chosen one, it's not really clear, is he out to save the world? Because in the end, he has a choice. And that choice is ambiguous. We don't know which choice is actually the right choice. And it's not as simple as just, well, one choice is going to save the world and the other choice will just destroy it. So I'm curious, can you talk about a bit why you sort of decided to go with, you know, kind of to go against the grain of that, you know, he just saves the world model?
Sure. I'm not sure. I hope that there's like no right and wrong answer to this, but I'm sure that what was going on was it's kind of a manifestation of my internal conflict with this sort of hero story, because like you say, it's about the quest and some of the archetypes that we have in fantasy, which is that you have the guy, and it's usually a guy, and I wrestled with myself, like, why do I have this male protagonist when I feel so strongly about gender issues in fantasy? So I wanted to kind of just twist it around as much as possible, and also why, if we naturally gravitate in fantasy towards the concept of prophecy, does it always go one way, and can you play with that and turn it around and say, actually, if you have this political society that has risen up around power, which is the power is magic, aren't there going to be lots of people that are going to try and interpret that prophecy differently? And if there are goddesses that are giving these prophecies, maybe they're not so straightforward, and maybe they're actually kind of messing with people. I always like the way that the Greek gods would kind of interfere with mortals and try and trick them and be amused by the effects of these cryptic things that they would tell them. So I wanted that aspect in it, and I also wanted to hopefully just overturn that notion that it's the hero and he's going to go do his thing and fulfill the quest and that's it. That it should actually sort of try and dig into what that means and what happens if they decide not to do it.
But he's still, I mean, Vidarian is still very much a very moral character. You know, he definitely sees things as, I wouldn't say black and white necessarily, but he's very concerned about doing the right thing, and he's a good guy. Whereas a lot of the times when you have kind of the hero that isn't out there to save the world necessarily, they're a little bit more conflicted in their own personality as opposed to about the quest that they're on. And in Vidarian's case, he's conflicted about the quest and his part in it, as opposed to, you know, just being a conflicted, I'm kind of a bad guy, sort of anti-hero.
Right.
Which seems to be kind of a typical, you know, not in it to save the world hero these days. Nihilism, obviously, is thrown about a lot in terms of fantasy. But you've gone in a very, you know, different direction, I think, with Vidarian. In that he is good, but he's not sure what to do.
Right. And I do think that is a trend that has come up in fantasy. Like you guys were saying, that there's not been a lot of high adventure fantasy lately. We have these kind of trends that have been having. One is towards paranormal romance and urban fantasy, and the other is towards this gritty anti-hero fantasy. And I like both of them, but I think it's probably part of my troublemaker nature as well. I was like, oh, well, there's not any of these books. There aren't books that are fast-paced adventure stories the way that we used to have, so maybe I'll try and get away with writing one.
That's interesting, because we were actually talking about how this is, it's a very quick-moving story. You have a lot of action. You kind of haze over the travel parts to get to the action, and it works within the context of what you're trying to do and where you're going. So to know that you did that deliberately is interesting, because it almost, in some ways, I wouldn't say pulpy, but it does feel more, it is about the adventure. Not the adventure. It is about the outcome and the journey as well. But you definitely you focus on the high points. And I was actually really curious. Okay, so some of the richest descriptions in the book are ships and sailing. Is this from personal experience? I mean, are you a bit of a sailor yourself? Or was this research? And if it was research, can you tell us a little bit more about what type of research you did and what your process is?
Well, I'm glad to hear that those descriptions worked, because it's 100% made up. I come from, I guess you could say, I come from ship people myself to a certain extent. My dad worked for the Navy for most of his entire career, and my family comes from Bremerton, Washington, which is a Navy town. So I had kind of the influence of the Navy. My dad had little model ship, you know, on his bookcase with all of the books that I would wander around when I was a kid. And so I always kind of romanticized it because it was present, but I had to do a lot of research. And unfortunately, there actually aren't that many ship-type books that I've loved besides Treasure Island. I love Treasure Island, which is not, it doesn't so much focus on the ship-type stuff, and I mostly actually kind of had to do my own historical research and go and look at models of the ship. I found a ship, I'm like, this is the ship that is the Emperor's Quest, so I can sort of place myself on the ship, and how big is it, how many people does it hold, and what does that mean for its place in the world? What are the biggest ships in the world? Because in the Age of Sail, ships of the line, you had first-rate ships, and so they were gigantic, like unimaginably large, to the point that they're almost not useful for adventure fantasy because they're basically cities on the water. So I kind of had to decide, no, the ships are actually smaller, and what I would call a ship of the line or a first-rate ship is going to be a lot smaller than what would have been considered a first-rate ship at the height of the Age of Sail. That, and I play a lot of Sid Meier's Pirates. I have to say, that was a big influence, because it really creates this fantasy of that world, you know?
That's awesome. And
that
of course,
actually,
sorry. And the end of the book, which I won't tell anybody, but there's a twist.
Yes.
On the ship. I won't say anything. But it's kind of cool.
It definitely takes the story in a direction that I was not expecting.
A fun direction.
A fun direction.
I know.
One of which we approve, obviously.
I want one.
So, okay, you mentioned Sid Meier's Civilization, or Pirates. And you yourself are a video game designer. So how much does that, I mean, I don't know what your specific job is in terms of video game design. Are you more of a storyboarder or the programming or the art? How much has that played into your story writing?
I think it can't not influence it. And I think the place that I've always been at has been this narrative place that's right in between the two. And people kind of want to box me into one side or the other, but it's hard to keep giving the answer, no, I like both. And I think that one of the things that I've become more interested in recently is a concept that there is a game in storytelling itself, that when you're writing, you're actually playing a game with the reader. And I think that J.K. Rowling does a fantastic job with this. She keeps you guessing constantly, and every little thing that she does, it makes you speculate, and that's what makes you turn the pages. And I think that's a game. And I think that it's one of the things that makes for great gaming, even in something like Sid Meier's Pirates. You have to have mechanics that kind of frame the world, and then the way you navigate through these is with a narrative thread, and great games almost always have both of those.
Right. I mean, you mentioned in your note the fact that you think of art as an interactive process. And obviously with your collaboration on the story or the history. But beyond that, I mean, there's so many different experiments going on with storytelling these days in terms of television, that they're getting people involved, that they get to make the choices. Do you feel that that's something that you would be interested in, that you're planning on working with going forward? Or do you feel it's just more of the story and the reader interacting on a personal level?
Yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated with both, but basically the more people that you get involved in any given project, it increases in complexity exponentially. So, for instance, while I would love to make a AAA console game, the things that are involved in that have more to do with politics and money and financing, and those are the challenges that you have to overcome to bring something great to the market. So I don't feel that those are my specialization right now. And if the opportunity came up and the right people lined up, I would jump on it for sure. But that's actually what leads to it happening or not happening, is whether you have the right financier invested in it and the right team to make it and the right time for the product and all that kind of stuff that you really can't predict.
One could probably say that of the book worlds.
Maybe. I mean,
at least beyond the writing itself, although you definitely need the support of
For sure.
Family, friends, readers.
It's a little bit similar, but at least no matter what, with writing, there's still basically just you and the page, and it can come down to that, you know, and you can, even if nobody would buy it, you can put it up on the internet, you can sell it on Kindle. The barriers that exist between readers and writers are just getting lower and lower every day.
Would you say the same is true? I mean, I wouldn't say maybe for like the top end, like not for console gaming, but certainly like people who release their own online games, you know, they don't go through the big whatever gaming companies who I'm so out of touch with now because I haven't gamed in forever. But, you know, there are people who release their own, you know, like Flash games, and they release their own like online world games and all of this stuff. I mean, you look like EVE Online was, if I remember correctly, was not originally with any major gaming company. It was sort of an independent project that is like exploded.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it does seem like maybe there are some winds of change, certainly not for console gaming because you're kind of stuck. But it does seem like there is some change also in the gaming world. Or am I making that up?
No, that's extremely exciting for Mystic. Uh-huh. Did I lose you guys?
Sorry. Yeah, there was a very long pause.
So. Oh, I cut out. Shoot. Sorry about that.
It's okay. Yeah, I mean, I think art as a whole, I mean, whether it be video game design or writing or television, I mean, the internet has done so much to open it up to a much broader community as opposed to just, you know, the companies with the backing and everything like that. And as you said, with a book, you could, at this point, you can actually publish it by yourself in a forum that people might actually be able to buy it because they'd be able to find it. Whereas, you know, a few years ago, you didn't have those tools. If you self-published, you know, you had to drag your book around bookstore by bookstore and hope that they bought it. Whereas now you can put it on, you know, any number of sites and people can download it immediately. It's a much more egalitarian sort of process these days.
Yeah, it is.
Basically
it,
what
it
I'm
is.
Getting to. And the fact that you were able to collaborate. I mean, I remember the old AOL days myself, although I wasn't smart enough to switch out CDs. I just made my parents spend the money.
We're poor enough, yeah. yeah, permission, yeah.
Oh, God, my dad was pissed. let's just put it that way. I don't think we even realized at the time that we were getting charged per minute. Or maybe he
did.
Oh,
wow, yeah.
And I deliberately didn't know. But it was very quick after that we got an actual ISP. But, you know, I used to hang out on IRC in the role-playing chat rooms. And, you know, those were when you talked about collaborating, it made perfect sense to me because there were some people that were doing some incredibly rich things. And this is back in the mid to late 90s, you know. Before we mm-hmm. had the even more useful tools that there are now, like, you know, the Google Docs and all that fun jazz where you can literally sit there and write to each other and stores everything and whatnot. So it's very interesting that that's how you got started on the process. Because I'm surprised that people that I used to write with haven't started on the same process. So I'm just rambling at this point, but it's interesting.
Yeah, it's the technology has made it a radically different world than it was, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and I think it's one of the most exciting times to be an independent creator now because you can reach so many people and you have so many tools, and like Sean was saying, this has come to games as well, and it actually makes it really difficult to stay working for a big company when you see what some of the independent people are able to do and how they're able to get their games out there and in many cases make a living off of it.
Yeah.
Right, for sure. So are we going to see a second and third? Obviously it says the book one of the Chaos Knight. So how many books are you planning on this series?
Yes, it is a trilogy, which I know some people have mixed feelings about trilogies, but oh, good. Yeah, I like the format where you know where it's going to end, you know, before you get out the gate so you don't get, you know, 12 books in and go, hey, wait a minute. I don't think the author actually knows how this ends.
That definitely has been true of some 12-book series. I mean, we'll hopefully George R. R. Martin
certain series that will not be named.
Certain series that
will
not be named.
Yeah, I sure hope so.
Named.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, he says he's going to finish it. George R. Martin says he's done in, like, I think two more books, he said.
Yeah, it was going to be
son
like
of the other guy.
Yeah, it just kept spreading out.
So we are going to get two, though. Two more books for a trilogy.
Yeah, the second book is turned in, and Lou's very happy with it, so that's great. And I just turned in the synopsis for book three.
Woo!
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
on
so
top
good.
Of it, that's impressive. I could never do that.
It's been intense, I have to say. I haven't been sleeping very much.
How long ago I'm kind of curious because I honestly, Sean over there knows more about the publishing process than I do. I deliberately try not to learn too much about it because it's so intimidating sometimes. How long have you been on the process? I mean, how long ago did you finish writing the book? And then, you know, how long ago did it get accepted and whatnot?
So this one, the first book was a little bit weird. The second one was a lot more, I think, what you would normally get where you write the book kind of in one long stretch. But yeah, I wrote the first third in 2003, sent it to Mundania Press, whereupon they said they loved it, but they had canceled that anthology. So they asked if I could write a novel. Could I expand it into a novel? Yeah, I know. It was great. It was like, okay, so they want a novel, but it's a smaller press. And I was thinking, oh, I like you guys, but I don't know if I like you guys enough for a whole novel because I'd like to make a real go of this thing. So I kind of put it away for a couple of years, actually, and my life got kind of crazy between 2004 and 2006-ish. and I didn't pick it back up until 2008 or 9. Something happened. When I got back into it, I started into the second third, and when I was writing the second third, I wrote a short story from the perspective of one of the main characters of the second third of the book, and I sold that to Beneath Ceaseless Skies, and I was thinking, okay, this will help me get back into the world, it'll help me develop the character, the background of this character who I really like, and maybe I'll sell a short story, and then maybe someone will see it, and I'll be able to kind of get a solicitation for the novel. And that was my harebrained theory that could happen, and then to my shock, it actually happened that way. I sold the story. I had been talking to Lou online a bit. I actually had asked him to look at something else, and then the link was broken to it. So he went and found this one on his own and said, hey, do you have a novel set in this world? And I said, of course I do. I can have it to you in 6 months. And so I hurried to finish it and gave it to him in March of last year, I believe.
And lo and behold, now and it's published.
It's published.
Yep. Yep.
That's really awesome. Interesting. Okay. So my last question, before Duke gets to clearing things, you know, and the finishing part. So it also says that you're an essayist on player rights on modern media ethics, which I find absolutely fascinating in the first place. But how much did your ideas about that, I mean, because we talked a little bit earlier about, you know, that you have this conflict between a society in power, because they have all the power, the magic, and those that don't. Is this part of your worldview in terms of modern media ethics and player rights, or totally different, since I haven't read your essays?
I think it's all tied together. I think it would be hard for it not to be, but I think it's tied together in a weird way, which is actually part of why it's a short book, why it's high adventure, why it's the kind of things that are not in fashion to write, because I think part of my connection with player rights and ethics is that there are all these people out there that consume media, and they're kind of crapped on by society and also by creators to a certain extent. You know, people make fun of fans. They don't have a great existence. It's supposed to be embarrassing to be a fan. It's gotten better than it was, but there's always been this bias against escapism. And they say, oh, that's just escapism, as if this is some horrible thing. And yet, if you dig into what's happening in the process of escapism, it's really kind of part of why we're alive. You know, it's to have this fantastic experience, to have this life of our minds and our imaginations, and that's kind of sacred to me. I think that that's actually awesome. And so I wanted to write a book that was actually paying attention to what people wanted from the experience of the reading process. I thought about the escapist experiences that I had when I was, you know, 13, 15, and how I had books that I just couldn't put down, and I would read them all night, and the aspects that they had of being fast moving, you know, and all of that, it has to do with connecting to the audience, and I think a respect for the audience, and that's what I think the player rights are about too.
That's awesome. So, okay, so we're running a bit long, so where can everybody find you so we can, you know, send them your way to send hate mail and everything to you?
Right, exactly, yes. Hate mail, more than welcome at erinhoffman.com. And my main page for The End of Our World is facebook.com/andovourworld, andovar.world. And there's, I think we just hit 1,500 people this week, which is pretty cool.
That is awesome. Congrats.
Thank you.
Cool. So you guys should all go check out her website, check out her book, which is should be on your shelves. If not, yell at your book people.
Yes.
A lot, because it's from Pyre, so it should be on your shelves. So I guess just really quick before I go out, I just want to talk about Griffins for a second.
Yes, absolutely.
Give our contact information and then we'll skid out. So, okay. So what's up with Griffins and pulling people around in boats and stuff? I mean, it just seems really beneath them.
Yeah, that's interesting because, the sort of Griffin conveyance thing, they would ordinarily move stuff around, so they can kind of adapt from moving stuff around to moving people around, so in a way they're thinking of the people as different kinds of stuff, and I think that's not quite as demeaning. I was very particular that I did not want people riding the Griffins, because then that strikes me as kind of beneath them. They wouldn't voluntarily just carry somebody around.
Unless they were desperate.
Unless they were desperate, yes.
Gotcha.
All right, awesome. So, all right, guys, so check out Aaron Hoffman, aaronhoffman.com. The book is Sword of Fire and Sea, the first book in the Chaos Knight series. It's out from Pyre right now on your shelves. Get it. And if you guys want to send us an email or a message, or if you want to send us hate mail, which we will send anonymously to Aaron, which this is our new thing now. We're just giving everybody the opportunity to send hate mail to authors.
Yeah.
But anonymously. It's silly joke.
That's great. By all means. Yeah.
So you can send us a message in four ways. You can send us an email.
SkippyandFanty@gmail.com.
Twitter.
Twitter.com/SkippyandFanty.
Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
Yes, Sean with a Y and Jen. Or you can leave a comment on the blog, which is where this will show up.
SkippyandFanty.wordpress.com.
Yep. iTunes reviews are always welcome. And, of course, if you've read the book, we'd love to hear from you. If she would love to hear from you, too, if you go leave a review.
Exactly.
Thanks for being on the show, Aaron.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a lot of fun. I really like your guys' podcast.
Oh, thanks. Well, we appreciated having you. So, all right, we'll see all of y'all on the flip side.
Yeah, next week.
Next week. Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
Caution. You have entered the podstruction zone. Please secure all podcatchers. Caution.
How's it coming, guys?
This won't go any faster if you keep interrupting.
Got it. Here's some steampunk, diesel punk, gothic punk.
Goth punk?
Gothic. Trust me on this.
Hey, you're the one who invited him to the show, Sean. I've got epic fantasy, sword and sorcery, and all the news on ebooks.
That's it. Check it out. Clock punk. Ooh, shiny.
I have space opera, time travel, Stargate, and...
Sean, is that He-Man?
Shut up. Boys, I think we did it.
A superior podcast.
Publishing, writing, genre, best-selling authors, and the hot new writers of today.
Editors and agents, contests? Did we leave anything out?
AdventuresInSciFiPublishing.com.
Subscribe today to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature since 2006.
Sean?
It's just so beautiful.
Podstruction complete. Enjoy.
Our new intro music is Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.